This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning for what is now our 43rd consecutive program dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic and our battle against it. It is a battle. And as I've said many times before, in any battle, you play defense and offense. Right now, we've been in the defensive stage, gradually getting into the offense. So let's look at the score, basically. We have over 437,000 Americans dead from the COVID-19 virus. Yesterday alone, there were 3,600 deaths in this country. But here's what we're starting to see, and here's where the hope, here's where some of that offense is coming up. 27.8 million people have received one or both vaccinations. More than 5 million Americans now are fully vaccinated, and we're vaccinating people at a rate of 1.2 million per day. Now, it's still a far cry from where we need to get to be, but it's progress that we're gradually making, and it's key for us in this battle. One bright spot is Connecticut. Our positivity rate for the last 7 days is 4.2%. That's the lowest it's been since early November. Right? Just yesterday, it was only 3.6%. So we're doing something right. And what's right is that's the defense, right? Fewer people are getting infected. And that's wearing masks, social distancing, washing hands, not traveling unnecessarily. In fact, we're one of only seven states that also has the highest distribution of vaccine. And that was brought out by Andy Slavitt in his press conference at the White House. So Connecticut is moving in the right direction. Here's something that bothers me. And that is, so our women's basketball team, the University of Connecticut basketball team, right? World-renowned, great team. You can't go to a game, right? You go to Gamble Arena, there's nobody there. And those are the things we have voluntarily participated in to keep those numbers down, to keep our state safe. Yet, they traveled to Arkansas this week to play in front of a packed crowd of 4,200 people in an arena in Arkansas. What are other states not getting? What are they not understanding about this virus and about what they should be doing? It is basic. Mask, wash hands, social distance. Right now in Connecticut, I want to make sure everybody is clear on who qualifies for the vaccine. Healthcare workers, nursing home residents, first responders, and with that, essential personnel, and residents over the age of 75. Soon, within the next several weeks, it will open up to all residents over the age of 65. But there are several limiting factors here. Among them is supply of vaccine. And we're going to talk about that in the next segment, is how are we getting around that? What do we know about this new vaccine from Johnson & Johnson that's out there? But when we talk about the defense and using masks, there's a lot of new information. For example, recommending that you wear two masks, right? So the bigger filter you could put between yourself and others, the better it is. One way you'll know if you're mask is not sufficient is hold it up to the light. If you could see light through that mask, what you're using as a mask, it's not sufficient. So a lot of people trying to use bandanas or gaiters, if you could hold it up and see through it, it's not appropriate. And I think, at least from what I see, it's rare that I see somebody out in public not wearing a mask. I have to say, I can't remember the last time I saw that. And sometimes it might be in error, being forgetful. But other than that, I've not seen people out there, at least in Connecticut, making some bizarre political statement by not wearing a mask. Now, one of our challenges are the variants, and we're hearing about variants, the South African variant, the UK variant. These variants are here. The RNA viruses, of which COVID-19 is one, are well known for being able to mutate quickly. So it's like they're camouflaging themselves to some degree and changing so that we can identify them and they can cause more harm. The way it does it is by letting it run loose. So if everyone wore a mask, ideally, if everyone wore a mask for several weeks, the virus, no matter what variant it is, would have nowhere to go and die. When people don't practice the basics of mask wearing, washing hands, and social distancing, the virus runs free and can change itself as much as it can, as much as it wants. And with that, we go back to, if people will remember, the recommendations of some people that we just let the virus run free. Remember that? You'll reach herd immunity if you let the virus run loose. Well, had we done that, we would have more mutations to try to deal with and ineffective vaccines. Our good fortune is that we have developed vaccines quickly from a platform that was already underway. So these vaccines have been well thought out and well studied so that we could use them effectively. The principal vaccine out there right now are the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. Those are the only two that have been approved so far. Those vaccines require two injections. One, the Pfizer vaccine, 3 weeks after the first one. The Moderna vaccine, 4 weeks after the first one. Now, I want to make a very clear point. This is something we do know. So one of the things that has eluded us is being honest about what we know and what we don't know. And as we know things, we need to make them more available to the public. So what we have found out is that those numbers of 3 weeks and 4 weeks are not hard numbers. So what we know now is that second vaccine can be given up to 6 weeks after the first vaccine and still have the same effectiveness. So it's important for people not to be nervous about, my appointment is 5 weeks after my first injection. So with that, we are starting to learn more and more about this. And I'm happy to see that the nation's experts are also admitting what we don't know about the virus, such as how long does this immunity you get from the vaccine last? We believe it'll last at least a year. It may be longer, may be shorter. We're learning as we move through this. Before we take a short break, I want to make sure everybody knows that I will take questions in this second segment coming up. The phone number's here, 860-522-9842, 1-800-966-9842. Also, I want to go over the questions that came up during the week, specifically on the topic of ivermectin. an anti-parasitic drug that has been purported to work as a treatment for COVID-19. Those questions came in to me on info@alessimd.com. And in the second half of our program, my guest today is going to be Dr. David Henderson. He's Associate Professor of Family Medicine, Chair of the Department of Family Medicine, and Associate Dean of Multicultural and Community Affairs at the University of Connecticut. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about the vaccine and how we reach minority communities. And also, we're going to talk to him about the future of medical education. Because when we move forward from this, we know we have to make changes in how we distribute healthcare in this country. And a lot is going to depend on the education of physicians. We're going to take a break and be back with you shortly. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And as I mentioned before, I've gotten several questions about the use of a drug called ivermectin. Ivermectin is an anti-parasitic drug that's approved by the Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of onchocerciasis as well as strongyloidiasis. Those are basically tapeworms, so parasites. And I've used this drug in Haiti, primarily in children who have had tapeworms, so it's fairly commonly used, fairly benign medication. And there has been a school of thought that ivermectin may be a treatment for COVID-19 based on some of its anti-inflammatory and antiviral properties. And that is, among those physicians supporting that is a Dr. Pierre Corey at the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Corey is legit. From everything I can tell, well-educated and well-intentioned. He's on the front line treating people with COVID. He's a critical care specialist. So the NIH has come out with their statement, and basically they're saying that there's not sufficient data to recommend either for or against the use of ivermectin to treat COVID-19. So we don't have the results from a well-conducted trial to say, this is the way to go. Kind of like where we were with hydroxychloroquine, when we finally did studies, and it's not hard to do these studies because so many people have COVID-19, we found that it wasn't helpful. But in ivermectin, those studies are ongoing. And how does it work? Well, it inhibits the important and it's called an important alpha beta 1 nuclear transport protein. Basically, this is the way, it's a key way for the virus to attach to cells and transport its material into the cell. It's how it gets into the cell. So if you could inhibit that, ideally, you then have a situation where the virus can't spread within your body. Now, it's been shown to do this and inhibit replication of SARS-CoV-2 in cell culture. But here's where the problem is. What they've found is to take what you've seen in a test tube and replicate that in vitro in a human being, you would have to take doses 100 times higher than what's been approved for human use before this. So that's where the rub comes in, is although it's benign in the recommended dose, we don't know enough about it in the higher dose. So with that, I think it's one of those things that we don't know about, but we're not saying this, we're not trying to poo-poo this and say it's not going to work. Here's what we do know. We do know that monoclonal antibodies do work. Remember this? The former president got this, and it was an antibody. These are antibodies made in the lab that you can give someone within the first 10 days of infection, and it attacks the virus from spreading. So it's an effective treatment. Here's what's happened is that we've got a bunch of this stuff sitting around. And what we're finding is that it's not being used. Why? Because you have to have an IV infusion of it. It's a one-time intravenous infusion of the monoclonal antibodies. It works for COVID-19. We don't know that it works for the variants. But for the most common COVID-19, we have those antibodies. They're made by Regeneron, but they're going unused. And the reason is because we don't have a lot of professionals to administer it. Everybody is working so hard in states where there's high influx of COVID-19. We think that's one of the problems. In Connecticut, there are monoclonal antibodies. So if you test positive, if you are starting to develop early symptoms of COVID-19, you should be in touch with your doctor, because this may be a key treatment to avoid you from getting very sick, requiring hospitalization. Again, these are drugs given before you get to the hospital, before you get to the point where you are short of breath and having a hard time breathing. So it's important to know that those are available and we should be using them. Let's talk a little bit about the vaccines. The J&J vaccine, you're hearing a lot of darn numbers, okay? 66% effective worldwide. In the United States, it's 72% effective. It's confusing, right? It's confusing to everybody. When you compare it to Moderna and Pfizer, which were 95% effective. Here's what the bottom line is. And our listeners who listen to me regularly know that I like to get to the bottom. I want to simplify things. So here's the simple line you need to know. Whether it's Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca, or Novavax, all have been proven to be 100% effective in keeping you alive. That's it. That's the bottom line. They all have had no one die who has gotten their vaccine and developed COVID-19. So we know that 5% of people who get the Pfizer or Moderna will get COVID-19. But again, mild symptoms, don't have to be hospitalized, don't die. Johnson & Johnson, I think what they're saying here is that 28% of people may get some symptoms, but again, don't go to the hospital and don't die. Why are their numbers lower? One of the reasons is probably because their trials, remember you have to get 30,000 people in it, were done later when we had more variants of COVID-19 and more cases. So there may have been some bias against the J&J vaccine when we look at those initial numbers. But we're also looking at numbers that say the longer you have it in your body, the more of a defense you build up with the Johnson & Johnson. And it's important to know it's a single dose. It's going to make it easy to administer. Also, Johnson & Johnson is known for their ability to produce large amounts of vaccine quickly as a company. So they are going to be able to produce a lot more of this. Their virus works a little bit differently. Their vaccine works a little bit differently against the virus. It uses what we call an adenovirus vehicle, which is kind of like a Trojan horse. It's not a real virus, but it looks like a virus. And it attaches to the same spike protein that the other vaccines attach to. It doesn't go in your cells. It doesn't make you sick. It can't give you the disease. But it will attack that spike protein so that the virus can't attach to your healthy cells. And that's the same way AstraZeneca and Novavax will be working. AstraZeneca and Novavax are still, Novavax is being used in the United Kingdom. They have not applied for emergency use authorization yet. The next key plan is going to be how we're going to distribute this medication. these vaccines. And in Connecticut, we've already put together a plan. The plan is to have many current and formerly active healthcare professionals unite. My colleagues who are nurses, retired doctors, retired pharmacists, healthcare technicians who are certified to give injections are massing together right now through the Department of Public Health. And there will be more and more mass vaccination sites. One is opening up in eastern Connecticut, I understand, at the Foxwoods Casino. Here in Hartford, the Dunkin' Donuts ballpark will be a mass vaccination site. My daughter, Stephanie, will be working with the Department of Public Health in working with them. She has a master's degree in public health, and she will be a vaccinator. As many listeners to this program may know, I am a volunteer auxiliarist with the United States Coast Guard, and they contacted me this week for deployment. And what we are doing is putting together teams of five vaccinators, and we will be asked to go to some area of the country to support FEMA in supporting these mass vaccination sites. I'm looking forward to it, and the reason I'm looking forward to it is because everyone who tells me that they've participated in these vaccination sites as a vaccinator come away with a tremendous feeling of satisfaction. It's why we went into this business. It's why we went into medicine. Nurses, doctors, pharmacists. We went in there to help people, and this is a direct way of saving lives. And that's what we really want to do. So I ask those listening who may be retired, we could be retired many years, don't be afraid. Sign up. Contact the Department of Public Health. Contact your former hospital where you used to work. I know Backus Hospital in Eastern Connecticut sent out an email looking for people. So we're amassing now because when these vaccines become available, we've got to get them in people's arms. Next up, we're going to be chatting with my guest, Dr. David Henderson from the University of Connecticut. We're going to be talking about distribution of vaccines, but also really the history and the future of medical education in America. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have you here for the second half of our program. My guest this morning is Dr. David Henderson. He is an associate professor of family medicine and chair of the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Connecticut. He's also the associate dean for multicultural and community affairs at the University of Connecticut. By full disclosure, Dr. David Henderson was my family physician until he decided to make the leap to full-time faculty back in 2003. Dave, I can't believe it's been 18 years now that you're at the University of Connecticut. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Tony. Thank you. That does seem like a long time, but it doesn't feel that long at all.
Well, you've certainly at least remained in Connecticut and been an asset. But I wanted to touch, in continuing with my discussion about vaccination and your role as Associate Dean of Multicultural and Community Affairs, one of the big issues has been vaccine hesitancy and among minority populations specifically, but in general. And what have you learned in working with the community? How are we going to get around that hesitancy?
Well, I think that the issue with vaccination is multifaceted and has some sort of interpersonal behavioral components, which I think the hesitancy is a major element there. But there are also some structural issues as well. And many of these issues we actually saw around testing. When testing was first rolled out, it was already clear that that people of color were being hospitalized and dying from COVID at a higher rate than the majority population. Yet they were underrepresented in testing, and it had everything to do with the way testing was orchestrated. I mean, if you remember, most of the testing sites were drive-up. If you didn't have a car, then those testing sites really were not accessible to you. And most of them tended not to be in inner-city neighborhoods or in rural areas. They were often sponsored by healthcare facilities. And so if you live in an area that has a healthcare shortage, again, your access to testing was very limited. Right now, we see people of color underrepresented in vaccinations. I read something the other day about Texas as an example. I think 15% of Latinos, so Latinos represent 15% of the population that's been vaccinated, yet they are 40% of the population of the state. They're disproportionately represented in people who are hospitalized and who die from COVID. And again, I think it's the same sort of structural issues. The populations that are being vaccinated first, i.e. healthcare workers in many states, a lot of these populations have underrepresentation of minorities to begin with. And even in sites where vaccination has been expanded, the sites are many of the same sites that offered testing before. And so that infrastructure is actually being sort of reused. And community-based vaccination is just starting to get off the ground in many places. And so it's actually very challenging. As an example, my sister's a school teacher in Chicago. And she is eligible to be vaccinated, but she has been unable to schedule an appointment because every time she logs on to the website, which is the only way you can schedule an appointment, it crashes. And so there are a lot of impediments to being vaccinated, in addition to the reluctance that is present in some populations, due to just sort of a history of mistrust with the healthcare system. And a lot of that is based on individuals' personal experience, not the things that happened 40 or 50 years ago.
Are we going to get around it?
Hopefully. I think there are many efforts by the system writ large and individuals in particular. I heard an interview with an ER doctor, I think she was in Texas as well, who was African-American and said that she was skeptical about getting the vaccination. But she went ahead and got it anyway because she recognized that it was the right thing to do. And she has made it a mission to try to get other folks in the hospital. Some of the nurses, some of the people who say work in housekeeping or in dietary, to be vaccinated as well. I mean, so she is using herself as an example, and has become an ambassador in her own sphere. I think that sort of community outreach, working with community organizations who have relationships with folks in the community who have credibility. I mean, I think efforts such as those should overcome the sort of current reluctance to be vaccinated, which is just, I think, just based on mistrust of the system.
Well, I'm counting on you, Dave. I mean, you are that person who you've spent a lot of years working in the Hartford area and in underserved areas, and there are a lot of people that look to you for good advice, as we do. So I'm hoping you're going to be successful in this adventure. But I want to get to medical education. One of the things we've been talking about in this program is, you know, in the future, we need a better healthcare delivery system. And a big part of that is going to be training physicians. And that's evolved a great deal, probably since you and I went to medical school. Can you talk a little bit about how we're training physicians and maybe touch on why we still have a shortage?
Sure. This is actually an exciting time to be in medical school, certainly to be teaching in medical school, because there is a lot of innovation and we're actually starting to see a lot of change. When you and I, since we're of the same vintage, went to medical school, we spent the day in some lecture hall or some series of lecture halls listening to people talk to us about this, that, and the other thing. It's very passive learning. The learners today are different, and the way that we approach them is different as well. I mean, UConn became the first school in the country to get rid of lectures. We haven't had a single lecture since probably May of 2016, because in August 2016, we unrolled a new curriculum. And that curriculum was developed by folks at the school, but I think influenced by a national group that we're part of. The AMA has a consortium of medical schools across the country. It's called the ACE Consortium. ACE stands for Accelerating Change in Education. And the goal is to foster curricular innovation. And so in our curricular reform process, we got rid of lectures. We moved to a system of teaching and learning that is more learner-focused and based on team-based learning as its primary sort of format. And its team-based learning, or TBL, is organized on the flipped classroom concept. So students are given information to go over to hopefully master before they come to class. They come to class, they take a short quiz individually, which is a self-assessment to basically see how well they understand the material. Then they take that same quiz as a group of 8 to 10 students. So if there are things that they didn't understand walking in the door, there's peer-to-peer teaching. Then the actual sort of class begins. If there are concepts that still need some elaboration or explanation, there are faculty there to do that. But most of the time in class is spent actually using the information. So students are given application exercises, which are patient cases that they go over and actually apply the information and the knowledge that they have just learned. So it's much more participatory than was the case when we were in medical school. There's another course that was created, which is called VITAL. We go crazy with acronyms, and I won't bother to tell you what VITAL stands for.
Thanks.
But it's our population health course. It's sort of based on an old health law and ethics course. But it adds a lot of elements of population health, and it actually includes emerging issues, which are usually based on current events. Issues like bias in healthcare, and there is 1 week that's being spent on the COVID-19 vaccine. Part of it is on the sort of biology of the vaccine, but also going into the distribution and access, which we were actually just talking about. So topical things like that are included. And it's an effort to try to help students understand how healthcare is delivered. Also, one of the things that the AMA-ACE Consortium has promulgated is what they're calling a third science. There's sort of basic science, clinical science, and the third science is health system science. And health system science is organized around the study and understanding of how care is actually delivered, how health professionals sort of work together to deliver care, and how the system impacts patient health and well-being. And the competencies that are associated with this include population health with a specific emphasis on health equity and social determinants, health economics, interpersonal skills, informatics, et cetera. And all of this is designed to achieve what's known as a triple aim, which is one, improving patients' experience of the care they receive, improving population health, and the third is reducing cost. The family medicine has added a fourth aim, which is improving provider satisfaction and well-being. But this is actually sort of a new sort of prism through which to look at the work that we all do. And this is becoming an integral part of the educational landscape.
David, I've found it very interesting. I had an opportunity to participate in one of these lectures as an expert in health and head injury, and it was phenomenal because it was a classroom was in the round, and I'm in the center fielding questions and using real-world examples for the students. So it is amazing. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to get back. We're chatting with my guest, Dr. David Henderson from the University of Connecticut. I want to talk a little bit about how we're addressing the cost of medical school and the presence of minorities in women and medical school itself. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds for our final segment. My guest today is Dr. David Henderson, who is the Associate Dean of Multicultural and Community Affairs and Chair of the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Connecticut. David, when we talk about medical school, one of the first things that comes to mind, when you ask students who are in pre-med, you know, or doing biology, and you say, you're going to go to medical school, and they just make a face. And a lot of it is dedication to the time element, but the other is the cost. And how are we going to address that, especially with respect to minorities and women and getting more minorities involved in medicine and going into practice?
No, I think that is a really important issue. I mean, I think sort of cost is an impediment. The way the sort of primary and secondary education is set up is also an impediment as well. But I mean, just with regard to cost, I think the average medical school debt now is about $216,000 across the country, and that's just for medical school. I mean, as a comparison, back in the late 70s, 1978-79, it was around $53,000, and the total average debt for medical graduates, including their undergraduate or college debt, is about $242,000, because the average sort of college debt is about $32,000. And so there are a lot of people who are graduating with a significant amount of debt, because $240,000 in change is about a starter house in most states, and if probably about 80 plus percent of students who graduate have some educational debt, and so that's a lot of debt distributed among a lot of individuals. And that, I think, is a barrier to some. I mean, right now, sort of tuition costs have gone up significantly since we were in medical school. The UConn's tuition is about $40,000, and that's fairly average for the Northeast. maybe actually a little bit below average. But if you go to a private school, your tuition is going to be about $60,000. And that sort of tuition number doesn't include any of the other aspects of cost to attendance, such as living expenses, health insurance, and so forth. And so once you add those in, the $40,000, I'd say, price tag for an in-state student can go up as much as $70,000, which, again, is a which is a lot of money. There are some students. I mean, if 85% graduate with debt, I mean, then there are significant number of students who graduate with no debt at all. They come from families that are affluent enough to be able to cover their educational costs. And so I think the cost is one impediment. It also, I think, has an impact on the disciplines that that students ultimately choose. And if you're looking at a big mountain of debt, then you are more likely to want to pursue a discipline that will provide a significant level of income to manage that debt. Although studies have shown that that really doesn't matter, but it's hard to convince someone who's looking at a couple hundred thousand dollars in debt that whether they make $250,000 a year or $450,000 a year, they can still maintain a certain sort of lifestyle.
Also, but Dave, that leads to this disproportionate allotment of physicians around the country, and you know, sadly, we don't have a lot of time. But it can you give us some idea, probably in the next minute, okay? Not too much pressure. How are we going to address the disproportionate allocation of physicians around the country when young people are faced with this amount of debt?
I think we need to fix the education system. And I think we need to start very early. I think we need to provide better educational opportunities for poor people in urban areas who tend to be underrepresented minorities. And we need to provide better opportunities for people in rural areas to become educated. We need to lower access to a college education. I mean, as because the rate of college graduation among African Americans is about, I think, about just under 20%. But women significantly outnumber men in that number. In fact, one statistic is that from 1978 to 2015, the rate of enrollment markedly increased for women in general, and enrollment in medical school also increased for all underrepresented groups except for Black men. Black men actually, those numbers actually went down. And so I think there is a lot of work to do, but that work, I think, in order for us to be successful, really needs to be done within the educational system.
Dave, thank you for your time, as always, and thanks for all the good work you do at the University of Connecticut.
Tony, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you.
And thanks to Joey Burgoyne, who's been on the board today. Many thanks to our studio producer, and it's great to have him along. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.